Into the Bad Quaker podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Monday, July 15th, 2013. Actually, it's Sunday, July 14th, but Kai and I are here in the studio, and we are recording this to be released on Monday. Hi, Kai.
Hello.
And this is podcast number 330. And let's see, do we need to have any cover any current business or anything that's going on? Other than, I just got home. Cindy and I just got home, Friday?
Yeah. I just got in last night.
And you got in last night. We had been on our extended visit from, leftover from Porkfest, where we stayed across campgrounds throughout the Northeast for what? How long has it been since Porkfest? A couple weeks? Yeah. Mom and I, we just, you know, traveled around in a van with a dog solving mysteries.
Would have gotten away with it, too, if it hadn't have been for you meddling kids.
You meddling anarchists and your dog. So that's what we've been doing since Porkfest. What have you been up to since Porkfest?
I have been doing the Kentucky Renaissance Festival. And that's over now. So I'm going to go, for 2 weeks. I'm going to the Penzic Wars in Pennsylvania, but I'm not actually going to them. I'm going to a campground adjacent to them and watching three yappy chihuahuas and a fairly mellow blue heeler.
We should give a little shout out to the Penzic Wars, because maybe some of our listeners don't know what the Penzic Wars are. And some might be interested in a small little oddity about the Penzic War. So tell us first off what the Penzic War is.
The Penzic War is among the world of sort of medieval reenactors. You have two different factions. You have the Renaissance Festival people, or Rennies, as we are known. And we do Renaissance festivals, which are not at all historically accurate in the slightest. There's a lot of glitter and fairy wings. And
it's more for fun.
It's fun. It's an amusement park. It's a vaguely historically themed amusement park. And then you have people who are from the Society for Creative Anachronism. We call them Skadians. And they do reenactments that are far more period correct.
In a sort of an odd twisted way.
That includes sometimes things like a completely period hand stitched linen outfit covered in duct tape armor. I don't know why. They weird things. But nevertheless, they do events where it's with the Renaissance festivals, it's a weekend event. And it is, you know, you go there and you vend for the weekend, and then it's closed during the week, and then you vend on the weekend. But the Penzic Wars is all week. It's 2 weeks long, and they have a big reenactment. It's a big, like, war. And I don't really know. I've never been. I don't really know if it's some historical significance
or if it's not.
I don't know.
I'll explain the historical significance.
Sort of, they're kind of crazy. Skadians are a little weird. I love them. They're great, but they're weird.
And fanatical. I think, is a better word than weird.
Yeah. I'm much more into the Renaissance Festival because it lets me, for 5 days a week, go swimming, hang out around campfires, drink whiskey, hang out with my friends, be a hippie. It lets me be a hippie for 5 days a week. And 2 days a week, I got to put on a funny costume and go to work. But the SCA, it's much more of a lifestyle.
It was formed in the 60s, and I don't have my notes up, and I don't have Wikipedia up or anything, so this is just coming off the top of my head, and there may be flaws in it. But it was formed in the 60s in generally speaking, the Bay Area of California, perhaps a little further south towards the Santa Cruz area, if I'm not mistaken, perhaps specifically in the Big Sur area, if I'm not mistaken. I could be off on that. It could have been up closer toward Milpitas or something. That's all geeky California nonsense. But anyway, so it was a group of people in the 60s, and that should tell you enough right there. but the Pinzig War, okay, so they don't actually try to reenact real history. They try to reenact as accurately as possible a made-up fantasy history that they have kind of drawn the perimeters for. And so it can be extremely accurate to real history, but it's more specifically extremely accurate to the history that they have decided that there is, that is acceptable to their little club. And so what you have is wonderful people, you know, some really creepy people, that's how humans are involved in this, and they're a worldwide organization. And at some point in time, the renowned, person, David Friedman, whom sometimes listens to this podcast. And David, if you're listening, I'm trying my best to not say anything to upset you or get you angry, because you and I are on good terms at this moment, so hopefully we'll keep it that way. But anyway, at some point in time, David Friedman became king of one of the sectors that the United States is divided up into. And at that time, he decided to declare war on another sector. And that, and this is the, again, as best as I understand it. And if David's listening, and if I get something incorrect, you know, David, feel free to log onto the forum and correct me on every bit of this, because this is David's game. I mean, he's one of the main players in this thing. So David, as king of this one sector, declared war on another sector. Now, the other sector didn't respond right away. And not knowing motivation, I have to fill in the blanks here. So David got himself elected, or however you do it, to become king of that other sector. And then he accepted the challenge to war that he had given to himself. And so as king of one sector, David attacked the king of the other sector, which was David. And David lost, or won, according to how you look at it. And that was the first Pinzig War. And then ever since then, and it was not reenacting any, like, historical event.
Right.
It was simply two factors of this large group of geeks who like to play, like to dress up, and they actually, as you know, they actually sword fight,
mm-hmm.
With blunted swords, I assume.
Yeah.
And other objects. And they joust, and they have.
I don't actually think there's any jousting at Pinzig.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think.
Well,
that
there may not
jousting.
Be because jousting.
Jousting is a serious business. Jousters are that the jousting community is very serious about what they do, and
they actually hurt each other.
They hurt each other, and they have you can't just be a jouster.
Mm.
You have to go through training, and they take jousting seriously.
So the first Pinzig War was David Friedman and his kingdom attacking David Friedman's other kingdom, and then fighting it out through this method of this this kind of fun fake fighting that they do. And then every Pinzig War since then has been a reenactment of the first one, if I understand the concept correctly. So they are reenacting a historical event. If you consider that the historical event that they're reenacting happened a few years ago, then yes, it is a reenactment of a historical event. But the historical event that they're reenacting...
Oh, it was over Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were fighting over Pittsburgh.
Yeah, the two kingdoms, whoever wins or loses gets Pittsburgh as the prize, which is kind of like... Oh, I'd better not say that. We probably have listeners in Pittsburgh. No, I'll say it anyway. It's kind of, winning Pittsburgh is kind of like winning an elevator full of fart. Okay, so anyway, it was not our intent to make this the all the All Penzic podcast.
But I am not going to Penzic. I am going to an adjacent campground and babysitting three chihuahuas and a blue and red heeler. Which, does that make it a purple heeler?
I believe so.
It is both a blue and a red heeler, and blue and red make purple.
There
Pretty
you go.
Sure it's a purple heeler.
Okay, so then...
But after that, I'm going to Tuxedo, New York, and doing the Tuxedo, New York Renaissance Festival, which I believe is just called the New York Renaissance Festival.
It's not called Tux, huh?
Well, it is, I mean, the Rennies call it Tux.
Okay. And that's kind of in sort of upstate-ish New York, right?
No, that's really close to New Jersey.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because you go over into New Jersey if you want to buy anything and don't want to pay ridiculous amounts of money for it.
I'm looking it up on a map so I know more about what I'm talking about.
The New York festivals are a little bit strange because there's two main New York festivals, and one of them is the Sterling Renaissance Festival. And one of them is the New York Renaissance Festival. The New York Renaissance Festival is held in Sterling National Forest, but it is not the Sterling Renaissance Festival. It's all very confusing. So there's a lot of, So Rennies have a tendency to just call it Tuxedo and Sterling.
Okay, I see where it's at. This is, yeah, your mom and I in the motorhome when we left, we were over in Pennsylvania for the Libertarian convention in Pennsylvania at Harrisburg. And when we left...
Also right next to a Renaissance Festival.
Yes. And when we left Harrisburg in the motorhome, we drove across eastern Pennsylvania and cut across Highway 84 really close to where... you're describing where the Tuxedo Renaissance Festival takes place.
Yes.
Horrible, horrible, horrible roads.
Yes.
Horrible roads.
Beautiful area.
Yeah, but horrible, horrible roads. On that trip, we didn't get into good roads, oddly enough, until we hit Connecticut. And here's an odd thing about traveling, too. We went through Connecticut and then up through Massachusetts and into Vermont on our way to Porkfest. And the closer we got, as we're going through Massachusetts, the closer we got to Vermont, the more vicious we were seeing the Massachusetts State Police attacking cars with Vermont license plates.
Oh, yeah.
And it wasn't just like, oh, you're 5 miles over, here's a speeding ticket. It was doors open, two or three cop cars. Things are being pulled out of the car, the trunk's open, and that's what we saw with every one of those car stops. And just from that little section going through, I don't know how many we saw, four or five,
wow.
You know, just going north. And then coming south, same thing. We're seeing, and all the cars that are being pulled over are going north into Vermont, out of Massachusetts.
Well, Massachusetts has decriminalized marijuana. And Vermont has not.
Oh.
I think. I don't know if Vermont has.
Or is it the other way around?
Well, I know it's only a... I know that Massachusetts has, and then it's only a ticket.
Hmm.
But...
Unless you're carrying a marketable amount.
A certain amount, yeah. So I don't know.
Hmm. I don't know, but they were vicious. I mean, they were just... You could just see these people feeding on the Vermont license plates.
Yeah.
You know? Which we cruise right on by Ohio, then nobody notices if you... Having Ohio license plates is kind of like vanilla ice cream. Everybody knows it's there. Nobody cares.
Yeah, unfortunately, Ohio is a very difficult state to be homeless in. As far as if you are of the mindset that you want to take as much from the state and you want to give as little back... Ohio is not a great place to do that in.
Hmm.
There are far better places to do that in. Florida is an awesome state to be homeless on paper, as long as you don't actually try to be homeless in Florida. Florida is a terrible place to be homeless, but it's a great place to be homeless on paper because they'll give you everything you need.
Hmm.
But don't try to sleep on a bench.
Wow.
because then you'll be put in jail.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky.
If you're not lucky, it's tased, yeah. Sprayed. So now, to kind of take us in a direction, you know, of the purpose of the podcast, you got a question from a, do we say listener or do we say fan or do we say family member or do we say crew member? Or anyway, you got a question about, sort of in the range of age of consent and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You want to explain the question a little bit?
Well, I was asked, what do you think a voluntarist society would do regarding a legal age of consent? I did not respond back. It was in text message form that I got the question, and I didn't have enough cell phone signal at the time to make a phone call, and that's not really an answer I can give in a text message, unless you want a novel. But
explain the string theory. Go!
Go! 420 characters. Aww. It's an interesting question. And it actually ties in. I'm reading Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces right now. And, that talks a lot about the idea of kind of the hero god itself being a metaphor for trials and, sort of actions that you have to take in order to go through something. So that kind of plays in really well with the idea of, you know, initiation and ritualized, becoming a member of the community and taking your place in the community. And these are things that don't happen well under the state, because the state says, you know, when you're 16, you can drive. When you're 18, you can vote. When you're 21, you can drink. And because of that, you have people at 16 who have no business driving who are driving because they're 16 and the state says they're allowed. And then you have people at 14 who are completely capable of driving who can't drive because they're not arbitrarily allowed because they haven't reached a certain number of years. Mm. And so it doesn't work. The whole system doesn't work.
And you have people 45 who can walk in and get a license with no problem who should never be driving.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you have people who are 65 or 70 who absolutely should have their vision checked like every 3 months or something because, you know, their level of deterioration is taking place so fast. And because they're such a powerful political entity, the old people are, then the governments don't dare cross them and make sure they can drive properly.
Yeah.
So you have people, older people with reaction times so bad that they should never be driving and vision so poor that they should never be driving. And government doesn't have the guts to stand up to them.
I'll tell you, the last time that I went in and got my driver's license renewed, they gave me a vision test. And at the time, I wasn't wearing new glasses. I was wearing old glasses. And I should have failed that vision test. If I were giving me that vision test, I would have failed me because I don't think I got a single answer correct. And she was just like, okay, move over here. They'll take your picture. I was like, why even have a vision test? Why? Why have a vision test if you're, I mean, thank you. I want my driver's license, you know, obviously. And I would like to point out that I'm not now driving with those same glasses. I have much better glasses. My vision is fine now. But at the time, I really should not have been given a free pass to drive. Like, that's not acceptable.
For a very long time, I played a little game whenever I'd go in to renew my driver's license. I have fairly good vision in one eye and not so good vision in the other. So when they would do the eye thing, I would always volunteer to do the good eye first, because this is deciding whether or not you have to wear glasses when you're driving.
Right.
So I would take my glasses off, look in the thing, and memorize the line that I'm supposed to read with my good eye. And then they would tell me, you know, okay, then they would flip the flipper thing. And now my good eye is blinded out. And now my bad eye is seeing. And I would just say what I remembered. I couldn't see what was there. It was just one big blurry blob, but it didn't matter because I had it memorized it. And it seems to me so obvious. You just said, like, you know, whatever it is, like E, L, C, D, B or whatever, right? Okay, if I'm looking at five letters for like 30 seconds, 30 seconds later, I can say those same four letters or five letters or whatever. I can do that. That's not a problem. So the thing is begging to cheat in it.
Right.
And I couldn't help but, I mean, given the opportunity to cheat the state like that, even though I gain nothing and the state loses nothing, just the fun of going, you know what? I wear my glasses all the time when I drive, but I'm going to beat this thing.
Yeah.
And I did that as long as my eyes would allow. And eventually my other eye deteriorated to the point of where I couldn't do that anymore. And I have to wear glasses and it's on my license now, but that's, we kind of wandered there away from age and onto other silliness of arbitrary decisions by government as to why we can and can't walk around and do the normal things in life. But, so the government, and not just our government, our, like we own it or like we're a part of it, but not only the government in the U.S., but all governments in all times have come up with goofy standards, whether it be, you know, when you turn 13, this has to happen to you, or when you turn, and some of these were culture-based, but governments adopted them. Some of them were traditions, or they were based on some magic ritual or some religious thought or whatever. But governments tend toward wanting to draw arbitrary lines and just say, because we've decided this is Mexico and this is the U.S., then this is Mexico and this is the U.S.
Now, and if you happen to be born on this side, you're Mexican. And if you happen to be born on this side, then you're, you know, an American. Well, that family has been living on that swatch of land for...
Yeah.
How can you just draw a line there? Well, because you have all the guns and you can do what you want.
And for some odd reason, people believe this silly mythology.
Yeah.
And so the same thing happens with other ages. For specifically, like age of consent,
mm-hmm.
or age of, you know, when a person can get married without their parents' permission, or when a person can get married, you know, oddly enough, you can't get married without the government's permission in America now.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really strange. As a licensed minister, I think that's stupid
mm-hmm.
for anyone to say, hey, here's a good idea. Let's have the government decide whether or not we can get married. That just, it blows my mind that people think that's a good idea. But the government loves to just draw these arbitrary lines and force them upon people. Murray Rothbard wrote on this extensively, and Walter Block has done some really good work on it as well. And, as best I can, I'm going to try to explain their position on this topic. And then we're going to kind of kick it back and forth and see if we can find some holes in it or anything. So basically the argument that Murray Rothbard and Walter Block have laid out is that, a child, let's take a newborn or even a preborn baby, because of libertarian rules, it has to own itself because every human owns itself. The problem is, as a tiny little infant, either, you know, not yet born or newborn or right in that time frame, they basically can't do anything for themselves. So because they can't do anything with this property, essentially this is unhomesteaded property, this human person, because the human entity that's in that body hasn't come to a point of where they can homestead it and do anything with it. So essentially this body of this person is unhomesteaded. Even though they technically own it, they have done nothing to make that step towards ownership. So then we have caretakers. And you can, if Lord of the Rings geeks will kind of understand this, the difference between the caretaker government in Gondor as opposed to the rightful king that was away and that had not come, even for generations, had not come down there and claimed their birthright. Well, technically, the whole kingdom of Gondor belonged to the king. But because he, for generations, had never been there, he did not claim that ownership. Therefore, and the caretaker government didn't have the right to homestead it. They didn't have the right to take command of it, to be king. They only had the right to be a caretaker. So that's all they could ever do. They could never really improve it. They could never really do anything serious with it. They didn't have the authority to do anything that could improve it or harm it. All they could do is wait for the king. Well, that's kind of the scenario that Murray Rothbard draws of a child. A child is, the body of the child is 100% ownership, belongs to that entity, that person who is in that body. But they have not come to a point of homesteading yet to where they can take the full authority of that body. So caretakers are in charge of the body. So the parents or adopted parents or whoever is taking care of that person is the caretaker with full authority to say, you know, I have to protect this person, or I'm going to abandon this person, or I'm going to feed this person, or I'm not going to feed this person, or whatever. The caretaker is the person who makes those decisions. Up until the point of where the child itself begins to homestead that property, they begin to do things like walking for themselves or feeding themselves, or they start to become productive in other ways. They start doing chores around the house, or they start doing things to earn their living, in other words. They more and more, a little at a time, they homestead the property of themselves, until eventually, at some point in time, they get to the point of where they are 100% self-sufficient. And at that point, when they can either earn money or work in some way that allows them the ability to pay their own way or to support themselves without the assistance of their parents, then at that point, no part of them is under the authority of the caretaker. They are entirely, they are in the Gondor sense, in the Lord of the Rings sense, they have been crowned and they now possess the kingdom. And that means the caretaker completely steps aside and has no place in the decision-making process ever again.
Right.
So that's kind of the Rothbardian Walter Block way as I understand it. So now let's put ages on this. So if this young child is 8 years old and they're unbelievably bright and they can invent new things, you know, and bring them on the market, and they can make a lot of money and they can handle their money and they can figure out ways to, you know, buy a house and get around transportation, all the things that they need to do at 8 years old, then in Murray Rothbard's argument and Walter Block's argument, they are an adult. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if their body is still growing. It doesn't matter if they haven't reached their potential yet.
Right.
None of those things matter. The only thing that matters is if they are self-sufficient, if they have the capability. And, you know, we all fall back now and then and have to help, have to use the help of parents or siblings or whatever. But if the person has the ability, the demonstrated ability to self-sustain, then at that moment they belong to themselves and they're an adult. Be that at the age of 5, 8, 14, 22, 35. There are adults because of handicaps that will never obtain that position, that will never fully come into ownership of their self. Because they are, you know, through physical ailment of one kind or another, they are incapable of ever fully taking care of themselves. So any caregiver that is kind enough assumes at least a partial responsibility by volunteering to be that keeper and help them. But again, that's a purely voluntary association. And in Walter Block and Murray Rothbard's assessment, the parent-to-child relationship has to be voluntary in both ways. Now, the child may not want that relationship, you know, when they're very, very immature. They may want to run away because they're mad at mommy and daddy or whatever. Well, if the child is not capable of sustaining themselves, then you know that that's a death sentence for the child to run away. He's 5 years old. He can't, you know, there's no way he's going to live if he runs away. So the parent has the authority as the caretaker to say, no, you can't run away. You have to stay here with us. And so that's not imprisonment and it's not enslavement. because there's not a person, you haven't fully homesteaded your ability to support yourself, therefore you have to stay. And so that's the Rothbardian as I understand it. That's the Rothbardian. So what holes do you see, or what problems do you see with this if it went society wide?
Well, I think that has a tendency to forget, and this is an issue that I see with a lot of strictly sort of libertarian thinking people. Human beings are inherently social creatures. We cannot function on our own. We are completely dependent on our packs or our herds or we are a social animal. And as such, we kind of have a dependency on other people because, and with that, we have a responsibility to other people as well. I have a responsibility to my neighbors in making sure that I don't, take this creek that runs through my property and dam it off completely so that it doesn't leave my property and starve my neighbor's fields. Okay, well, yes, in a strictly libertarian society, in a strictly ANCAP society, that is perfectly legal. It's my water. It's on my property. I own it. I can stop it. I can make it into a pool and swim in it. It's mine. But that affects my neighbor's fields. And if it affects my neighbor's fields, then the whole community is going to be short food this year because I've decided to take food out of the entire community. Now, is there any legal problem with that? Well, no. But as a social construct, those humans can say, okay, well then fine. You don't get any of the food from that field. None of us are going to sell to you. None of us are going to help you out any. And so there are repercussions to actions. And I think that because all of the social repercussions to actions have been usurped by the state, that people forget that societies have great power. Just as a community, as a group of people living in a shared space, there is tremendous power to influence the behavior of others. I see this at the Renaissance Festival on a daily basis. I live in a campground with between like 20 and 50, sometimes 75, sometimes more, sometimes less, people. And we live together. We hang out together. We are all a community, and we don't call the cops. If something goes wrong, if somebody gets drunk and starts a fight, we don't call the cops. We break them up. We send that person home. Maybe we don't talk to him. Maybe we don't let him get work at the next show. Maybe we kick him out of our community. Maybe we forgive him.
But it's on a case by case basis.
But it's on a case by case basis. And it's something that each individual member of the community can decide. You know, every member of the community can decide that they're done with this person and that they're not going to have any associations with him. But if he hasn't harmed me, I can still interact with him. And that doesn't lower my standing in the community any. You know, communities can function just fine without an outside state force that makes it function. And so I think that when you're looking at, you know, how would these things happen in a stateless society, you kind of have to look at, well, how have they happened in a stateless society? You know, if you take, let's say, at what age can a person get married? Well, that depends on not only the person, you know, but also what that society has deemed acceptable. If that society has deemed that even if a person is mentally ready at age 8, they're not really. That, you know, you need to wait until they've hit these key milestone markers in their life. And those sort of ritualized initiations into the community are something that human beings have done since we crawled out of the forests and began walking upright. Or, you know, whatever. But it is something that we've done since day one. You know, communities need ritualized initiations into certain parts of life. And what has happened is we've taken all of those and we've handed them to the state. And so as an American, there is no, ritual for me to become an adult that does not involve the state. You graduate from high school. Well, you graduated from a public school, or you graduated from a state sponsored school in some manner, you know, and then you get your driver's license first, and that's state. There's no communal ritual for that. There's not the community coming to you and saying, welcome to being part of our community. Here's what we expect from you. Here's what you can expect from us. There's no voluntary agreement that happens there. There's a social contract with the state that says, you're 21, you're allowed to drink now, you're an adult. If you mess up, we're going to put you in a cage. Well, that's a recipe for disaster.
We need to break here for our commercial, and when we get back, we'll go into this further. Do you have an Amazon account? If you don't, let me encourage you to set one up. Setting up an account is free and it's easy. Amazon has great prices, and in most cases, you can avoid paying sales tax. Plus, if you're careful and lump your purchases together, you can even get free shipping. And Amazon has almost anything you can think of. Plus, it's safer and cheaper than driving all over town. When you buy stuff, if you follow the Amazon link at badquicker.com, Amazon will give badquicker.com a tiny portion of the purchase price. It won't cost you any extra, but you will be supporting this podcast. Thank you. Folks, there's only a finite supply of gold and silver in the world. However, politicians can print paper on a whim forever and ever. Hedge yourself against inflation and a volatile stock market by purchasing gold and silver bullion from Amagai Metals. As inflation gets worse, it will become more difficult to buy gold and silver. So secure your financial freedom today by visiting AmagaiMetals.com. That's AmagaiMetals.com. Or you can give them a call at 1-800-882-8496. That's 1-800-882-8496, where financial freedom is yours. And be sure and tell them BadQuaker.com sent you. And thanks for sticking with us through the break. I'm Ben Stowe with Kai.
Hello.
And it's really nice to have Kai back in the studio, and it's nice to be recording in a studio.
Not over Skype.
Yeah. So now we're talking about age of consent or these arbitrary lines that the government draws, and we're talking about how really distorted our view of all these things are because for so many generations, Americans specifically, but really it's around the world, but Americans specifically have turned over society's responsibilities to the aggression of government. And we less and less, generation after generation, less and less we question, is this something that government should do? We don't even question that. We just hand it to government. You know, and those few of us who see something wrong with that are the oddities and
the crazy people.
Yeah. And we're the ones trying to say, look, this is not the traditional way of doing that. It's not like with marriage. It is not the traditional way. Traditional marriage is not government sanctioned marriage. You know, no government body sanctioned the marriage of like, Joseph and Mary, you know. Or Moses and either of his two wives. No government sanctioned those marriages. The marriage was a community thing. And part of the problem, I think, with libertarians and ANCAPs as well, is that oftentimes we hear words like society, community, you used one a minute ago along the same line, or maybe cultural, things like that. And immediately, the ANCAP or the libertarian thinks of socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And something I was talking about at Porkfest is the difference between spontaneous order and central planning. And usually when you say central planning, immediately the libertarian or the ANCAP or the, you know, anybody who doesn't like the idea of being told what to do, as soon as you say central planning, they get this thing in their mind of like a Soviet council that
right.
decides how, you know, how, what are the length of toothbrushes and how many nails should be produced this in this quarter, in this sector.
In a big gray slab building.
Yeah, yeah. But what we don't realize is central planning, like I said at Porkfest, Porkfest was centrally planned.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between Porkfest and, say, some government function is that we were all there voluntarily.
Right.
There was no gun pointed at anybody saying, you have to attend here or we'll throw you in jail.
Central planning is what makes a garden happen.
Yeah.
If you go out and you plan out your garden and you plant things and you decide where you are centrally planning a garden.
Yeah.
Now, that's not a bad thing, you know. But it has to be voluntary. Not on the garden's part, but just central planning in general.
You support the enslavement of cabbages.
I do. I support rounding the cabbages up and putting them behind walled-in fences, because otherwise the deer will eat them.
And I think, you know, that's something that libertarians often have a tendency to skip over when they think about these things. They think, you know, well, the old one is, who will build the roads? Well, okay, so people who want roads will build roads. Okay,
right.
So we solve the problem there. The problem is solved. People who want roads will build roads, or they'll hire somebody to build a road for them. And who will that be? Well, it'll be anybody who wants to, you know, buy or sell goods that need to be moved from one place or the other. So there's a vested interest in getting the roads built. And at the same time, then if 20 or 50 or 1,000 people decide that they all will put money together and hire a company to build a road, then in a libertarian, you know, lib pair, as the freedom fiends like to say, in a society like that, the roads would get built by a road crew, and then there would be regulations on who can drive on the road and how they can drive and how fast they can drive. It wouldn't just be chaos with people just, you know, oh, there's a road. I want to ride on that. I want to drive on that road. I want to go 300 miles an hour. It wouldn't be like that. There would still be rules. There's nothing anti, ANCAP about having rules, because like my house, I have a house and I own the house. And if somebody decides they just want to come in here and build a fire in the middle of my house, I have the right to shoot them in the forehead or slice their throat, whichever, you know, appeals to me at the moment. And that's because there's ownership of that house. I own the house, therefore I'm not going to let them come in and build a fire in the middle of it. Well, the same thing in an ANCAP society where someone has built a road. They're going to have regulations. They're going to say, if you're going to drive on this road that I built, you're going to drive like this.
Mm-hmm.
And if I catch you driving otherwise, then, you know, the door's kind of wide open. As far as in an ANCAP society, punishment could get very aggressive. Punishment could be horribly harsh. And this is what this is some of the criticism of ANCAP theory, is that there would be no limitations to,
but it
to
does
things.
Not behoove society
exactly
to kill people for driving 5 miles over the speed limit
right
on a private road. That means that you have just lost a consumer of your goods.
And also, and you've lost a certain amount of legitimacy in the community.
You have.
Which, and even though we're using a word like community and things like this, and we're talking about the thinking
you
of
can
the,
say
of
market.
The people.
You
the,
can say yeah, you've yeah. lost legitimacy in the eyes of the market, you know, if that makes people more comfortable.
Yeah.
You know.
But either way, there's these mechanisms. If you remove the state, then there's all kinds of levels of mechanisms built into society that respawn and that come back out from where they used to be centuries ago.
And it will never be as harsh as the state, because right now in the United States of America, you can get murdered by a cop for going 5 miles over the speed limit. You can.
Yeah, and that doesn't mean that the cop will spot you on his radar and then sniper shoot you through your windshield and you're dead.
No.
But the process can lead to your death for something simple like unmowed lawn or 5 miles over the speed limit or whatever. If you don't fall into line and do exactly like you're supposed to do through all the steps of interacting with the government goon, whoever he is, whatever level that he's, whatever, you know, whatever job title he has given himself, if you don't interact according to their rules, at some point they can shoot you, they can kill you. And
there is no repercussion for that, because there's no option within the market. So they cannot lose legitimacy because they have a monopoly on that good.
Right.
It's not like you can say, well, I don't like Joe's roads, he's crazy, I'm going to go drive on Edgar's roads. You can't do that, because they're all the state's roads. And so no matter which road you drive on, you're driving on the state's roads.
So in a perfect ANCAP society, you could have roads that the owner of the road says, you know what, I don't want anybody under 30 driving on my roads, and I don't want anybody over 31 driving on my roads. You could have that.
Mm-hmm.
And that person, as long as he actually owns that road, could enforce it pretty much however he wanted.
Yep.
But the thing is, would society tolerate that?
That's stupid of him.
Yeah.
Because let's say you're a business, and let's say Joe wants to build a road where only 30-year-olds are allowed to drive on it. And he comes to you and says, hey, I want to do this, will you help me fund? No. I'm not going to help you fund that. I'm not going to – no. And I'm not going to advertise it for you. And that does not help me as a business in any capacity. So – no.
Not only that, but your credit's not good here. You're crazy, and
yeah,
you're wanting to do something like that. I don't want you around as a customer.
Yeah.
There are plenty of other customers. I don't need you.
Yeah.
And here's, you know, and this is a kind of takes us down a different road, or takes my thought down a different road. As far as something as controversial as like racism, you could have, in an ANCAP society, you could have a nasty, monstrous, racist jerk who has decided that, you know, nobody, of any, let's just say nobody of any Jewish heritage within their lineage at all can come inside their shop and buy their, you know, whatever the goods they're selling. Let's say they're a restaurant, and,
right,
and they will not serve anybody of Jewish lineage. Well, that'd be horrible, but they have the right to do that because it's
right,
their business.
Because it's their property.
And what can you do about that?
You cannot go there.
Yeah, that's what happens. And you can let other people know. You can stand right outside of their property, as long as you're not on their property, with a big sign that says, this guy is a racist pig. He is a jerk, and he's anti-Semitic, and you can say these things, and you can drive all around, and anywhere where there's where the property owner will allow you, you could put up a sign that says, don't do business with the jerk down there who's a racist. You could do that.
Mm-hmm.
You could even go so far within an ANCAP society, and this would not violate the zero aggression principle. You could lie about him. You could say he eats babies. You could spread the rumor all around that he has satanic rituals in his basement where he eats babies and kills kittens. You could do that. And it wouldn't be against, in giant air quotes, it wouldn't be against the law.
Right.
Because you're lying about him. But on the other hand, if the community figured out that you're a liar, then they probably would shun the stupid racist with his restaurant.
But they would probably shun you too.
And they would probably shun you too. They would probably refuse to sell you food, refuse to allow you on their property. And the thing about an ANCAP
society,
shunning
is the most effective form of social reprimand.
It really is.
Because there is nothing that you can do by yourself. Now, yes, you can in theory, go off into the middle of the woods and make all your own food and make all your own everything, and you will go crazy.
Yeah, but this is going back to what you said a second ago, that humans are social characters. We're social creatures.
Yeah.
We do not do anything very well by ourselves.
Yeah.
We really... And this goes into divisional labor, something economists understand. Yes, you can grow, you know, all your food within a fairly reasonably small area. You can grow all your food. You can set up rabbit hutches. You can set up chicken pens. You can, if you have enough acreage, you can maybe have a couple hogs. You can, if you have even more acreage, maybe you have, you know, a milk cow or goats or whatever. You can do this and be entirely self-sufficient. And you can do it one person,
mm-hmm.
You can never really do things like have a cell phone, fly around the world. You can't do that level of stuff on your own.
You can't do things like have a piece of farm machinery.
Yeah. Yeah, because you can't smelt the iron and, you know, all these things.
Or refine the gasoline that it takes to run it, or
right.
Any of those things require outside assistance.
Yeah.
So you're stuck with basically 1400s hand tools.
Yeah.
To try to get you by.
Or worse, or Stone Age hand tools.
Stone Age hand tools. Which, yeah, people existed in the Stone Age. People fed themselves. People lived.
Right.
But I don't want to live like that.
Yeah. So society has these mechanisms that are held down. They're literally governed. That's what the word like anybody who's a mechanic knows what a governor is. A governor is not necessarily that really corrupt politician that's in a special town that we've somehow designated as a capital. A governor is a machine that goes on another machine that holds it back, that restricts the speed that it runs at, or the amount of horsepower it produces, or whatever. A governor is something that holds something else down. And it's funny that we use that phrase, governor and government and govern to govern. It is literally that which holds us down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a good thing. It doesn't hold us down because like a motor, we would overspeed and destroy ourselves if there wasn't a governor. That's just demonstrably false.
Right.
That is not the case. What governs us and what holds us back currently is a small organization of human beings who have decided for themselves that they own us, they will dominate us, and our labor will feed them, and therefore they govern us. That's the system we have. But if you took that away, then we would self-govern, and that means that society would govern itself. People, individuals would govern themselves, and society would govern itself. So there would still be limits to behavior, but those limits would be a combination of what individuals choose voluntarily and then what all the other individuals around them choose to tolerate from them.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there are all kinds of societal mechanisms to do that once you remove the one and only thing that current government has, which is a monopoly of violence.
The other thing that you have to understand is that while it is true that each individual human being owns their own person, other human beings also own bits of you too. For instance, let's say you have a family and you have one family member who is viciously murdered and robbed. Well, what do we have then? You can't make amends to that person. That person is dead. However, you still have a family that is impacted because you have removed a member of their family. You have You have taken something from every single one of those people. Mm-hmm. And so those people, having owned that
emotional relationship, yeah,
are owed something because you've taken it away. And maybe it's even that person was earning money and supporting those people, and so now you've taken that money away, so there's retribution to be had. So when you have...
Or maybe it's just emotional.
Or maybe it's just emotional.
Knowing that they're there, hearing them talk.
Yeah.
You know, the companionship of having them there has now been stolen from you.
So, you know, as a child, if you have, you know, let's take something terrible. Let's say, you know, you have an 8-year-old child and she is abused by somebody outside of the family and or inside the family. It doesn't matter. You have not only hurt that child, you have hurt the future adult that child will become.
And all their interactions
and
with everybody
exactly,
that's close
to them. All of their interactions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something to where, as a society, these are the reasons that we have cultural parameters, because each individual person is not a separate entity. Now we are a separate entity in that what I do is my responsibility. It's my responsibility to feed myself. It's my responsibility to clothe myself. It's my responsibility to not infringe on other people's rights. But as a community, it's our responsibility to ensure our continued survival as a human species. Because otherwise it really doesn't matter what you do. You know, if you are the only person you are responsible for, if you are not responsible for your descendants, if you're not responsible for your future, lines of humans to come, then it doesn't matter. Gobble up all the resources, burn the whole planet. It doesn't matter, because you've only got between 40 and 90 years that you're going to be around anyway, so it doesn't matter.
I think this is really important, because this is the difference between Randian way of thinking from, you know, Ayn Rand.
Mm-hmm.
The Randian way of thinking very much goes in that direction. It's very individualistic in the sense that I don't owe anybody and nobody owes me. And the problem that comes in with that is that, yes, on a strictly libertarian law matter,
mm-hmm.
this is true. This is the case. This is how you do libertarian law.
Yes.
But that's where the actual libertarian separates from the Randian.
Yeah.
Because the Randian takes that and applies it to society. And that's stupid.
Yeah.
And it just won't work. It will end up, you know, if you took it to its logical end, then you have, how many people are there? However many billion people there currently are.
Like 6.5 billion.
I think it may have broke 7 billion.
Oh,
but let's just say, for the sake of terminology, let's say there's 6 billion people. Well, then you have 6 billion people who, if they're all following Randian thinking, they should be all killing each other as quickly as possible so that they can gain what the other owns. Now,
right.
Of course, the Randians believe in, in non-aggression towards mm-hmm. each other. So you're not supposed to steal and kill and things like this. They believe that. But if you actually take the theory out to its furthest extent, then okay, maybe I can't kill you, but I can gobble up as much resources as possible and leave nothing for my children.
Yep.
You know, and that's perfectly acceptable. And if everybody thought that way, we'd die off in about 2 generations.
Right.
There would be no more humans.
Right.
Because it's unnatural. And some people argue that there's no such thing as natural law. And I think that's a very limited way of looking at it. Because if there is no such thing as natural law, then, you know, what keeps an alligator from just killing and eating all the other alligators around him? What keeps, when sharks are swirling around eating prey, why don't they just eat each other? Why is there not only one really big, powerful shark left alive? Because sharks tend not to eat each other. That's natural to them. See? And so why is it that wolves don't just devour one another constantly? It's because natural law is built within them, hardwired into them not to do that. And so, of course, there's natural law for humans. But, like we said, all these things are distorted because thing after thing after thing has been given into the responsibility of the government instead of us. And so we've lost our ability to detect that natural law, mm-hmm. even to the point some people believe that there is no such thing.
Yep. And it's very sad because we have a society that doesn't actually know how to be a society.
Yeah.
That's really sad.
It's become a childish society that can't take care of itself. And this takes us back to the Rothbardian thing. Literally, today, the individuals in society no longer own themselves, and the caretaker is a very evil thing. The state, this religious concept of government, that government is good, that is now our caretaker. And we as a human race, we have to grow up and take responsibility for ourselves and take ourselves out from underneath the responsibility of government so that we can actively own ourselves and so that we can become the individual kings, you know, that king of Gondor, like I was talking about before. Mm-hmm. We have to put ourselves into that position and we have to take that. We can't wait for the government to say, okay, you're grown up now. You can make your own decisions.
Because they won't.
They want to keep us in a childlike state for as long as possible. So, Kai, thanks for coming on the show with me. You're going to be around for a day or two. We might get another podcast in before you leave.
We might.
Or you might not.
I don't know.
But anyway, thanks for coming on today. Absolutely. And folks, thanks for listening today. And be sure and get over to badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.